Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guest. And this evening we have as a guest one of my favorite. His name is Dr. Joe Douglas. He's worked for in intelligence for many years back in Washington, D.C. He still lives in that area. He's written several books, which we have interviewed him on before, and one of them is called Red Cocaine, going into the involvement of the communists and the drug smuggling and industry throughout the world. And of course, as we'll develop this, they could not get by with this. The communists couldn't without help from very powerful forces within our society. And then, of course, his book, Betrayed, which we do carry, the story of the men we left behind in Korea and in Vietnam. And, yes, even at the Second World War, we abandoned between 20 and 25,000 American troops. And most Americans don't even like to think about this sort of thing, and yet we have to remind them of what's going on and what has gone on in the past so they can really understand what's happening today. As our young men come home from Afghanistan and from Iraq, within 30 days, about 30% of the returning veterans are ill with some sort of a disease, and the Veterans Administration has no idea what it is. We'll call it post-traumatic stress, but it's really not post-traumatic stress. It's some sort of an autoimmune disease, probably related to experimental vaccines or other experiments or depleted uranium, that because they use our fighting men as guinea pigs, but we can't tell the American people that. Terrible things are going on today. But, of course, there is hope, and that's what Easter is really all about. And the fact that there really is the resurrection of our Lord, and there certainly, although we're not going to do a program on Easter, I just want to remind all of our listeners that this is Good Friday, the date we celebrate the death of our Lord, and is being placed in a tomb, and then, of course, 2 days from now will come Resurrection Sunday. So, really, as we talk about all the terrible and bad things going on in the world, I want to also remind you that there is hope because he died for our sins. And with that as a background, Dr. Joe Douglas, thank you very much for being with us tonight. Dr. Joe Douglas, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So I'm just going to let you go ahead and pick up the story.
When you speak of the difference between reality and illusion, what that brought back to my mind was the tremendous problems associated with the flow of illegal drugs into our country and why it is that nothing seems to happen, why the problem keeps getting worse and worse, even though the money spent on the war on drugs each year increases along with it.
You know, it's sort of like the war in Vietnam or the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. It's not a war we're really trying to win very hard.
No, as a matter of fact, when you look at the drug problem, what has struck me over the years is that drugs succeed. The illegal drug problem grows, not just because of traffickers, and certainly not because of the thirst Americans have, but really because the trafficking is politically protected. And that's one of the hardest things for anyone to understand, to really get their head around, if you will.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to convince our listeners this evening that the drug epidemic is being protected. Dr. Douglas, go ahead with the story there.
Well, I think the best way to tackle that problem, Dr. Stan, is by some concrete examples. because the charge is very difficult for anybody to really believe, let alone understand, because the idea that the government was protecting the flow of drugs just doesn't make sense to people, because we think that they're all out there fighting hard to try and stop the flow of drugs.
And, you know, the amazing thing is a lot of them are. There are people working their heart out in the DEA, and people working their heart out in the CIA, and people working their heart out in the FBI, but there are other people who have a different agenda, and that is what people don't understand, this dualism. One side, we have people who are doing the best thing they can in customs and all, and then on the other side, there are people, I like to refer to them from the dark side of government, who have a different agenda. And until we understand that, it's so difficult to understand what's really going on today.
Well, that's certainly one of the things that caused Mike Levine to write a couple of excellent books. Now, Mike was a top DEA undercover agent, and he discovered after a number of years that he was very frustrated. And the reason he was frustrated is they'd worked for several years to develop a good case on some drug kingpin, let's say, and at the same time wrapping up a number of people who were corrupt in the process, politically, particularly political authorities, and they get to the point of wanting to move in on the people and get them arrested and thrown in jail, and all of a sudden they would be told to keep their hands off, stop the thing, and go on to another case. And invariably, the suggestion that's put forth was basically, well, higher-up people say we can't do anything on that because of the involvement of another agency, and usually what was taken was that there's some CIA operation that's tied in there, and they don't want to expose them by going after these drug lords.
Now, who wrote the books about this?
This was Michael Levine.
Oh, Michael Levine, okay.
And he wrote two books that are excellent. One is Deep Cover, the first one he wrote, and the second one was The Big White Lie. And, of course, The Big White Lie dealt with cocaine and the supposed effects, efforts to stop the flow of cocaine into the country that were all really blocked by various other government agencies, difficult as it might seem to believe. Now, one of the ways to get a handle on this whole problem, I think, is to take a look at two administrations. And the ones I look at are the Republican administration of Nixon.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Arthur Stan, and Dr. Douglas is simply talking about one of the men who'd worked on this. His name was Michael Levine, and he had written two books. One was called The Deep Cover, the other, The Big White Lie. And, of course, the basic story was almost the same. Mr. Levine had worked for many years in the drug enforcement, and only to find that when they'd have cases, really, that showed obvious involvement of people in key positions in government helping the drug smugglers, why they're all set to move in and arrest these people, and higher-ups, of course, prevent them from doing it. And so the books are out there, the information's out there. We have a great book, because Dr. Douglas's book, Red Cocaine, and then, of course, we have a great four-tape set on the drug smuggling interviews with six different people. If you were to listen to these interviews, you'd be firmly convinced that people highly placed in our government are doing everything they can to perpetuate the drug epidemic. But Dr. Douglas was going to talk about two administrations and their relationship to drug trafficking. And so you pick the story up, Joe.
Yeah, the two are the Nixon administration and the Reagan administration, Dr. Stan. And the reason for picking these two is because they're the two that have worked the hardest to build up an anti-drug image. And so let's take a look at what they've really done. Now, the Nixon administration, when they came into office, there was an awful problem in drug use among the GIs over in Vietnam. And there was also a lot of drugs from Vietnam that were coming into the United States. And one of the first things he did is they sent Lew Walt, General Lew Walt, who was a retired Marine Corps general, a very respected gentleman. And he went over to find out what the drug thing was all about. When he came back after a few weeks, he wrote a report. And This report basically said that the drugs were rampant among the troops in Southeast Asia, that the drugs came from China, and that they were not being trafficked against the Americans to make money, but rather as a weapon of war. And that's understandable when you look at what happened as a result of the drug use. As was told to me from a friend in the Air Force that did an investigation on it, that they lost more people to drugs than they did to combat in the 1970s. And they would look at the security on bases, and when they arrived, they'd find out that 60 or 70% of the people in charge of security were on drugs themselves. So you can get an understanding of why it was such a problem. Well, General Walt presented his report into the people at the White House, and then he got called up to talk about it, and they basically told him two things. Forget about this report and don't tell anybody about it. And as he later explained to a friend of mine in the airport, he ran into him, we were both catching planes, and he said, you know, that was the most damnable order I have ever received in my entire military career. And of course, the problem was that the people in the White House didn't want anybody worrying about China trafficking in drugs. That would interfere with their new initiative toward China. And so rather than do something about it, they decided to cover it up. And not only did they say that to General Walt, but they also stopped reconnaissance flights over the area that were mapping where the poppy fields were. And there was also a memorandum that went out signed by Henry Kissinger to all the government agencies that said, well, there have been some rumors about China and drugs, and we want you to know that those rumors are false, and nobody is to spread those words in the government. So the word was out. Don't talk about China. Now, at that same time, curiously enough, the CIA had sent over a team to find out what was happening in the drugs. And I talked to one of the people on the team, and he said, you know, we got so much data on the drug flow in Southeast Asia that we could even tell you the names of the mules that were hauling the heroin down from China. I said, China? And he said, yes. You know, he said, that's where we drew the original golden triangle. And that triangle covered parts of Laos and Thailand, a little Burma, but the main part of it went up to Yunnan province in China, and the tip of that triangle was up near the capital, provincial capital of Kunming. Well, they turned that report in to the White House, and after about 18 months, it was desanitized and came out, and he got a copy of it, and he said, you know, I was really surprised when I saw it. Now, they didn't take that much style out of the report, but what they did is they took the triangle, and they turned it and lowered it so as to exclude China from the Golden Triangle, protecting China. And you know, to this day, when you look at any of the State Department reports on China, and you'll hear word of the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia, you will never see China included in the Golden Triangle, even though it was the major contributor to all the flow of drugs. And that's the way they protect that flow of drugs, and particularly because they didn't want to interfere with their policies toward China. Now, there is another example from that same administration in the same time, which is one of those things that's sort of like hitting your elbow. You don't know whether to laugh or cry. When they came into office, very shortly, there were two reports that came out, both of which identified Bulgaria as a main drug trafficker, as a state operation, and money launderer. The CIA had a report coming out on that. The DEA had their own report on that. And curiously enough, we even had a defector from Bulgarian intelligence who brought with him documents explaining that that was the case. Well, Dr. Stan, you would not believe what our State Department of Customs did at that time. They got together and they went over to Bulgaria to talk to Bulgarian Customs, which was a branch of their intelligence agency. And they told them that they would like to teach them our techniques for catching drug traffickers so that they could better protect and police their own borders. Can you believe it?
I can believe it. Almost anything, Joe. See what I've seen through the years.
Well, that's what they did. They started and they sent people over there to instruct the Bulgarians on all our techniques so that they could improve their own techniques. And after about 5 or 6 years, they finally decided, well, you know, they weren't getting anything back. They didn't get anything from the Bulgarians, and the Bulgarians never seemed to take action on any of the people they identified as drug traffickers or follow up and change some methods. It's like it was a one-way street. But not only a one-way street, the Bulgarians were improving their methods every day. Well, it took them 5 years to recognize that, and they still didn't stop the practice. Can you believe it?
Well, I can believe it, because I think the American people must understand that you could not have as inefficient a war on drugs as we have unless it was planned that way. And it's just exactly the way we fought the war in Vietnam. We never fought it to win, and we're not trying to stop the influx of drugs into the United States or throughout the world. It should be so obvious to anybody who stops and thinks. Think about who controls Afghanistan today. We do. What is the greatest center of heroin production in the world today? Afghanistan. Completely under our control. We could spray the fields. We could burn the fields. I've seen pictures of American soldiers standing in the fields surrounded by opium poppies. Why do we do something about it? Aw, shucks, we're so busy fighting the Taliban. We're making money from the sale of the opium that we can't do anything about the fields. It just doesn't make sense. Any intelligent person would know that this is being fostered by our own government, but we can't let the American people know that.
No, as a matter of fact, speaking of Afghanistan, it's another excellent example. When that war started, one of the reasons put forth for fighting it, as Tony Blair said, was to destroy the supplies of opium and heroin that were being shipped into Great Britain, mammoth supplies there in Afghanistan. And we actually did capture them, but then what happened? Did we destroy them? No. What we ended up doing is turning them over, as I understand it, to several of the various drug lords in return for getting their support. Again, that's the same type of thing we run into. It's just, it's like we didn't care one bit. And as a matter of fact, that's what Ed Epstein found out. In the early 70s, after Nixon had really been into this war on drugs thing, Ed, who was an excellent historian, went in to really take a look at what the Nixon administration did. And what he found out in all the people he took to and reading official papers and everything else, he found out that they were very interested in anti-drug insofar as it affected the politics. They wanted to make good political coin out of their image as tough drug traffickers. There were also a lot of people there that saw it as a wonderful opportunity to build up their own little empire in DEA or what have you, in the various agencies. But the one thing that Ed never found was anybody who was seriously concerned about actually stopping the flow of drugs. Just unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. I talked to Ed a couple of times, and he never was able to run into anybody or find any paper that looked like it was at all concerned with fighting the war on drugs. It reminds me of the statement that John Mitchell made one time. Said, don't listen to what we say, watch what we do. And he didn't mean it in that sense, I'm sure, but boy, that was the case, and that's what we find every time we look at the government efforts to stop the flow on drugs. Lots of talk, lots of money, lots of people at the lower levels that are seriously concerned about it, but when it comes up to the top, the people that are running the show, and make political mileage out of it, or build up their own empire, but that's about it.
And then all the lives that are lost and are destroyed, and the families are destroyed because people get onto the drug habit. And I mean, why would anybody want to encourage the use of drugs? Well, you can see why the Chinese communists would want to encourage the use of drugs by our people during the Vietnam War. That's a great way to demoralize an army. Same thing happened in Russia during the Afghan War when they were fighting over there. Somebody was pushing drugs onto their young people, and of course they had a terrible epidemic of drug use, and that's of course how AIDS got established so well in Russia. But of course you have to ask yourself, who's doing this? Why? Don't they people have any compassion for human dignity, or maybe they have another agenda? We'll go ahead and pick up the story there, Joe, please.
Well, let's, you talk about this agenda that they have, And I think one of the people that really laid it out for people to see was William Van Raab. He was the only person I ever talked to in the administration that looked like he was really serious about that problem. Willie was head of Customs Department under Ronald Reagan. And he was one of the first people fired when George Bush came in and took office. And it's really understandable when you look at the things that he was concerned about and what he said about the drug problem. When he tendered his letter of resignation, he didn't just say he was quitting for reasons of health or to spend more time with his family. What he said is, we got a problem here. And he laid out some things that are, when you look at it, unbelievable that somebody would be that candid in telling the truth about what was happening. For example, one of the things he said was, and this is a quote, that for the past 8 years, the State Department has objected to every effort to control foreign drug production, thus earning them the title of the conscientious objectors in the war on drugs. Now, that goes a long way in explaining what the nature of the problem is.
And I think even more so when you understand that the Council on Foreign Relations controls our State Department and Council on Foreign Relations Trilateral Commission. So basically what you're having is these elitists are the people who are really blocking efforts to what is logical to protect our people from drugs.
That's right. You know, there was a statement, the hearings about 1988, probably 87, 88, and the State Department testified to Congress. And the things that they said about there were all, let's say they were illusion, not reality, as you would say. This is what they said. They said that, explaining to Congress, they said, narcotics trafficking in Latin America, Asia, the Middle East, and Europe is dominated by traffickers who are governed only by their greed and whose only ideology is the pursuit of profit. Nor do we have evidence of the communist conspiracy to use drugs to undermine Western democracies or our own society in particular. Now, I'm not too sure where these guys were living, but there could be no one that is more living in a land of illusion than these people from the State Department. It turns out that we did have evidence of the communist conspiracy. We had massive amounts of evidence from communist conspiracy. As a matter of fact, the former head the old Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, back in 1952, made it quite clear that the rise in narcotics problems we started experiencing then in 1951-49, he said was not organized crime that was the biggest drug dealer in America. It was Peking. We had that statement very clear. In congressional hearings, they were identifying several communist countries that were very active. The state was active, the top officials in moving drugs. Nicaragua, they had in the hearings, Cuba, Bulgaria. And when I saw that, it struck me that, well, you know, if these guys are involved, the Soviet Union is involved. So I had, at that time, had a number of contacts with people who had defected from the Soviet Union, and I went and I talked, or Eastern Europe, and I talked to one who was the only member of the decision-making hierarchy ever really to defect. And I asked him if he had any idea of Soviet operations in narcotics, international narcotic trafficking. And he looked up at me and he said, of course.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas, and simply talking about how the State Department and so many high officials saying there's absolutely no communist involvement in drug smuggling. Absolutely not, you know it. And, you know, it's sort of this idea that anybody who thinks there's a communist involvement in the drug smuggling is just absurd. But Dr. Douglas had run into several people who certainly had suggested this was a very real issue. And so he knew this one man who'd been a very highly placed official in the Communist Party. Was that that general, the Czechoslovakian general?
Yes, it was General Jan Sena.
And, of course, did he say when you asked him if the communists, the Russian communists, the communists throughout the world, were involved in drug smuggling? What was his reply?
He not only said, of course they are, but he gave me, line, chapter, and verse of the whole operation from the day it started. Czechoslovakia's involvement, how it was led by Khrushchev himself in particular, they followed the Chinese trafficking that had begun in 1949, 1950, and decided it was so good they were going to get it into it themselves. How they built an entire apparatus for doing this. How they built the drug traffickers' school so they could train people. And then over the next 20 years or so, they recruited and trained something like 26,000 drug traffickers from every country around the world. And how they had a major operation to move drugs into the United States that they believe from their own calculations, they then controlled in 1968 about 31% of the drugs coming into the United States. And even controlled a little bit more than that for the distribution inside the United States. Moreover, he pointed out that, you know, making money was not the real objective. That was just a side benefit. The real objective was the damage that it would do to our young people, and later on to such places that were specifically targeted, such as the military, the inner cities, and the grade schools. And they had elaborate strategies for these things. They're just amazing when you look at it. But there's no way that anybody would say that the drug trafficking in all these various countries were dominated by, you know, Latin Americans or Asians, only motivated by their greed. What they didn't realize or close their eyes to was the fact that all these guys had been recruited by the Soviets so that the Soviets would not be seen as having a direct involvement in it.
In other words, they were quite ready to use the criminal element, but of course they wanted to get the drugs in here, not only for profit, but to help demoralize our society.
Absolutely. And the drugs were great to push into the young men for two reasons. Number one, that would weaken the military because of its effect on their morale and effect on their health. And number two, because it would weaken them in their morale and their ability to think. And this would mean in 20 years later that we'd have a whole crop of very weak leaders running our country and our government. So they had multiple objectives, and they revised the strategy, you know, every year. The second thing that Von Raab said in his resignation letter, he looked at the Treasury officials, and he said, the Treasury officials have a distinct lack of interest in the drug efforts of Customs Service. Now, that's interesting. Here you got the Treasury with the IRS, and they don't really care about $150 billion annually of unreported income. You know that something is very awry if that's the case, and it's not a mistake. Then he looked at the Department of Justice and said they're only interested in protecting their own turf. And I saw that firsthand, and he's absolutely right. And then the fourth point he raised is one that really shows the types of things that are happening here. He said maybe it is time for the war on drugs to take its place as our nation's top priority, to enable it to interfere with other interests such as banking and third world debt. Well, you know, it's not entirely clear what he means. So let me translate. What he really was saying was that cocaine that he had tried hard to stop before it came out of Colombia, said the cocaine produced valuable cash flow that the Latin American countries needed to service the debt to the New York banks that they owed. And that's why other agencies in the government stopped the customs efforts to halt the production and flow of cocaine. And as a matter of fact, when I was reading Mike's second book on the Big White Lie, I came across a paragraph where he stated almost word for word that same thing. That's why their efforts had been shut down, because they didn't want that flow of cash to the Latin American countries cut short.
And, of course, these are devastating charges. I believe they're absolutely, totally true. There's so many books out there on this, but you're never going to hear them discussed on regular radio. I mean, we've done many interviews on this, and we do have a four-tape set. Six interviews. Is there really a war on drugs? And you're going to want to get Dr. Douglas's book, Red Cocaine, and think about these things very seriously. Maybe this explains why we're not ever going to win the war on drugs. Well, why don't you pick the story up there?
Love to, Dr. Stan. And I want to pick it up with an example that I think every citizen that sort of looks around and wonder what it's doing to their state or their city or their local area needs to think about. And this is, and this particular example exists in every state, but it's particularly good in the case of Arkansas because of some books that got written. And the one that probably covers a little bit of everything in there is called Boys on the Tracks. And the author is a journalist, Mara Leverett. Now, what happened was there was a lot of movement of drugs into Arkansas and other parts of the country that was piggybacked on the efforts of the CIA to, and State Department really, to furnish supplies to the Contras in Nicaragua. And, you know, they'd take humanitarian supplies or guns and ammunitions down there going down, and on the way back they'd pick up their load of drugs and bring it back to Louisiana or North Carolina or particularly Arkansas. Well, a couple of teenage kids had sort of heard rumors about drugs being dropped out of aircraft flying low at night, and then they sort of scouted around, learned a little bit more about times and where. And then they decided to go out and intercept a flight and see if they could get some free weed. And, well, they got out there and they got caught by the people that were there to intercept the shipment. And they were shot and then tied on railroad tracks, so it looked like suicide. And they got run over by the train, of course, when it came along. Well, the one of the mothers was dissatisfied with the autopsy, and she had another one conducted, and that's when they found out that the guys had been killed before the train hit them. And then she started digging into the problem of getting, you know, the state police and prosecutors involved and the various inspectors to see what happened, who murdered her son and his son's friend. Well, this went on for years and years, and she's never gotten any satisfaction out of it. And what happened is as this thing proceeded, they started to come into all sorts of contact with the various government agencies, and in almost every one, they found one or two people or heard about one or two people that were also looking to try and figure out where all this drug was coming from into the country, up particularly around MENA Airport, since that's where the CIA operation was run out of, and also there were people from IRS and other agencies that are concerned about a lot of money laundering that was taking place, which started to surface a little bit in the election back around 1990.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Douglas is talking about the episode as far as the MENA airport, a CIA operation, and of course we were flying humanitarian supplies and weapons south to the Contras, and then of course bringing back drugs, and the CIA was involved in that, and of course there were people who tried to expose that. One of them was Terry Nichols, and of course he ended up actually getting indicted himself and wrote a wonderful book called Compromised, and really lays the whole thing out. The book's out of print now, but we do have interviews with him on a number of occasions. And here's what happened to a courageous man who wanted to stop the, you know, the inflow of drugs, and of course he himself is indicted for drug smuggling. So pick the story up there.
Mother started really digging into this and looking for help everywhere. And she ran into the same stone wall in all the different agencies. She would find one or two people that were very sympathetic, some that were no longer there that she was able to contact later on when she heard about them. But in all cases, people started getting interested in it, and the minute they did, they either got fired or demoted or transferred or threatened with their life, and so many of them got out of the state. In other words, when you find out something is going wrong and it's fairly big or has a long tail and you don't know what you've got a hold of when you grab it, who do you go to for help? Well, when you got a lot of corruption, drug-oriented corruption in the state or in the city, you're going to have a hard time because you don't know who is corrupted, and chances are the majority of all the officials you want to get help from may end up being corrupted. And that was true here. Every state agency she ran into was basically corrupted. She'd end up being optimistic because here was a grand jury that was going to look at it. But then the grand jury is turned into a farce by the attorney that presents the data, because he never presents the complete case, only a little bit of case, so it looks like it gets a total whitewash. And then, of course, all the records are sealed and you can't look at them.
In fact, I can remember, of course, looking into this quite a bit when we were at that time doing a lot of interviews, and one of the young men who was investigating this, I'm sure they killed him. He felt his life was in danger. And I mean, here's a guy, 35 years old, top-notch physical shape. He sits down in a dental chair and just suddenly dies. You know, things like that just don't happen. But and, of course, I know one of my friends, Pat Patriciana, was investigating that. And the FBI infiltrated his operation, infiltrated his office. His man, he thought was his closest friend, one of his closest friends, who was actually financing, was actually an FBI informant who fed him information that got him sued. They would do anything to keep the American people from learning the truth. Actually, my friend, his name was Pat Patriciana, actually put out the video, the Clinton Chronicles, about the escapades of Bill Clinton and the drugs at Mena Airport. And then they put out another DVD, mentioned the names of some people in the local government who were involved with drug smuggling and the death of the two boys in the railway tracks. And it was a setup. Then, of course, they went after Pat, and they pretty well destroyed his life. And the FBI was deeply involved in this whole effort of infiltrating his office, of surrounding him with government informants. I mean, what in heaven's name is going on? Why would our intelligence agency being protected murderers and certainly drug smugglers?
Well, that protection is very interesting, because nobody could figure out that question. Nobody had an answer to it. And then about mid-90s, as I recall, somebody dug out a memorandum that had been signed by the head of the CIA, Casey, and by the Attorney General, I believe that was William French back then. And what it was is it was agreement between the Department of Justice, really, and the CIA, where it was elaborating on the crimes that the CIA agents, when they uncovered in the course of their duty, would report to the Department of Justice. Well, this is a long list of things. You know, I forget whether there were 30 items or more on the list, but it was a long list. And I read through the list, and I read through it twice. I thought I'd missed something the first time through, and then it struck me. There was nothing on the list stating that drug trafficking was a crime, or money laundering. You know, so the CIA basically, and this was in 1981, it was before all of the air flights on Amina and everything else was started. It was all planned and on the way, so they did it in anticipation of it, strictly to cover their backside, knowing full well that they were going to, what they were going to be seeing, and they didn't want to be caught by it, so they have an agreement so they don't have to report it. And this is done strictly between Casey and the Attorney General. How sweet. Now, the case that they know they're going to be caught is brought out by some hearings that were held into the nature of these flights down to Nicaragua in the late 80s. And in the process of the testimony, it came out that every single pilot that was hired was either a known drug trafficker or under indictment for drug trafficking. Now, pilots aren't that scarce of a commodity. I mean, you've got all sorts of pilots in the Air Force. The CIA uses them routinely. They can borrow them from the Air Force and put them on the payroll and use them. But they can't if they expect them to be doing illegal activities. So there they want to hire contractors to do the work, because this gives them plausible deniability. And, of course, that's what they operate for. And once they say that, well, nobody's about to really question them, and the Congress is about as useful as a bunch of two-year-olds when it comes to having oversight over the CIA. As an example of their past practices, I remember the assistant to the deputy director of the CIA telling me that in the 1960s, the CIA was fighting its own war in Laos. It was known as the Secret War in Laos. and he said that when they looked at what the war cost and what they were spending, he said it suddenly appeared to him. You know, it was like a light bulb going on. He recognized that the cost was 10 times more than what they were spending. So the money had to come from somewhere. He found out that it came from their drug trafficking operations. And the director knew, the deputy director knew, the two people over in Congress that had sort of an oversight knew, as did their chiefs of staff, and everybody looked the other way. And the head of the CIA, Helms, always adamantly said that, well, you know, we do not allow drug trafficking as a matter of policy. Well, they may not, but that doesn't say they don't turn their head when they see it and allow it to go on, which they have. So there you have an operation that corrupted the whole state. You got the various lines of command in the organizations that are corrupted by it, two lines of command. One led up to the governor's office. The other led up to the vice president's office in Washington. So nobody could get anybody held accountable.
And, of course, the vice president at that time was none other than George Herbert Walker Bush.
So that's the way the story goes, and that's one of the horrendous stories. And the book is an excellent book, not only in showing how all these things fit together so well, but the one thing that you come across and you look at and you say, that can happen in any state. All she's describing really here is Arkansas, how they fit together, but when you look at it, it's going to be in every state. Because if you look at the amount of drugs that are being sold in the United States, they're a factor of 4 or 5 over what is claimed, because the claimed use of drugs is according to statistics, which are absolutely known to be totally fraudulent because of the way in which they collect the data. So you have a total drug flow of revenue is, let's say, a minimum in this time frame of $150 billion a year. Nowadays, it's over 200, without question, I would say. And you cannot have that size of an illegal business going on into the United States. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to recognize this. You can't have that much illegal business going on without tremendous corruption in the cops, in the courts, in the law and order apparatus, in the politicians, the financial houses, the banks. I mean, everybody's going to be on the take. And it's going to be cumulative, with more people being added in every year.
And, you know, the thing that really bothers me, Joe, is that today in American prisons, we have over 2 million people in prison. But if you take the people on probation and parole, you're talking almost 7 million Americans. And so many of these, of course, are the victims of drugs and the weakness of their character that allowed them to get into the drugs. 7 million Americans, prison, parole, probation.
Yeah, and these are all the guys low on the totem pole, the expendable ones.
Right, of course.
You could arrest all of them, and in 2 weeks, you'd have a whole new crop taking their place selling drugs on the street. But the big guys, you don't see many of them.
Amen to that. 1 out of every 3 young black men is in prison, parole, or probation. 1 out of every 3 young black men in America in prison, probation, or parole. What's wrong with this picture, especially when the CIA is involved, and we even have the CIA Inspector General's report put out by the Inspector General of the CIA admitting that the CIA was involved in drug smuggling in Central America during the Iran-Contra period. But you're not going to see that posted on most people's websites. In fact, the fellow who got that, originally posted it, Mike Rupert, the FBI had infiltrated his office, and last thing we heard of him, of course, he was up in Canada. It appeared that he'd been seriously poisoned. I don't know if he's still dead or alive, but go right ahead.
You know, that's so true, and the whole thing, the way it's rigged, it makes you angry. I gave a talk, I was asked to give a talk by the American Bar Association, it must have been 10 or 15 years ago, by their National Security Division. And this is in Washington. They must have had a couple hundred people there, at least in attendance. A large convention ran for 2 days. I was speaking on the second day. First day, I was sitting there listening, and after a while, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Here you had speaker after speaker and comments after comments, all talking about what a wonderful job they're doing setting up these laws that may be in effect in 10 years and will help them grab money launderers. What they weren't saying is that by that time, you know, the money launderers will have changed their practices and their laws will have no effect. Number two, they could have all the information right now if they wanted it at no cost because it was all available through the various intelligence agencies. And probably 60% of the attorneys that were there worked in one of the intelligence agencies at one time or another and knew darn well what I was talking about, which is why I guess they never asked me back after the talk I gave the following day. But I was reading a book on money laundering. Very impressive. Looking at the statistics, you know, they're looking at it globally, and of course, money laundering, organized crime and drugs is usually 30 to 50%, something in that range, what it's generally credited with being. And their estimates were not that bad. They were estimating that the money laundering portion of the profits, just the money laundering, the portion that was money laundered, as being roughly, I think they said, $3 trillion a year in the early 2000s, 2001, 2002, or 2003. It would be over $5 trillion easily today. And not only that, but they only looked at 21 countries to get this underground income estimate. And the places they looked at was United States, Canada, and most of the European countries, and Japan, and Australia, and New Zealand. The places they didn't look at or couldn't look at were Russia, Eastern Europe, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, all of the money offshore islands around the world, the Middle East, Israel, the Arab countries, China, Singapore, Hong Kong, all of Latin America, all of Africa. I mean, all of these places are major money laundering operations. They didn't look at one of those. They couldn't. And their estimate was still, you know, today's terms, you know, over $5 trillion. Add in these rest of these places, you just have unbelievable amounts of money for corruption around the entire world. And in looking at the cost of the money laundering policing they had, it's laughable. You know, in the United States, it was about $40 billion a year, I think was their estimate on its cost. And what they were able to sequester or seize was something like $700 or $800 million a year. I mean, they've built up a wonderful cottage industry for themselves that is it is absolutely useless when it comes to having a dent in anything that's meaningful in terms of the trafficking is concerned. And not only that, but they really assiduously avoid looking at the participation of states and national banks, and the majority of the big banks. And you can't have that kind of trafficking without that run and managed by the banks. I mean, again, that's another common sense type of thing. And one of the things that SENA told me, they had so much money coming in, they didn't expect it, and they weren't looking for it, but there was so much coming in the mid-60s in their operation, this is the Soviet East European operations, that they had to redesign their money laundering system so that handle the money. And who managed the reorganization? Was it the KGB or the STB or GRU, the various intelligence agencies? No, it wasn't. It was international finance that did it for them.
Wasn't that nice of them? And, of course, what people do not understand is the close relationship between international finance and international communism.
That's right. And it's been there since day one. And, you know, Dr. Stan, I think one of the most revealing things that Jan said on several occasions, and I never asked him about it particularly, but it just came out because it was relevant to what I had asked. He said that never was there a decision made in Moscow that international finance was not present.
Now, I think that is probably one of the most profound things that our listeners will learn tonight. Would you mind repeating that? This is General Senya, who's a high-ranking general in the Czechoslovakian military and certainly then in the Czechoslovakian government. Would you repeat what you just said?
Yes, he said, never was there a decision made in Moscow that international finance was not present.
And I think if any of you have not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it and read it and understand how from the very beginning of communism, why we funded it. And we're still funding it today. If you get my March newsletter, we simply give you Professor Sutton's testimony before the Republican National Convention in 1972. The points out that we funded the communists all during the Vietnam Wars, and then they funded the North Vietnamese, who funded the Viet Cong, who were killing our boys in South Vietnam. And you have to say, how could they be that stupid unintentionally? And the same thing's going on today. We fund, of course, Pakistan. They fund Pakistani intelligence. Pakistani intelligence funds the Taliban, and the Taliban kill our boys in Afghanistan. It's deja vu all over again. Well, Joe, would you go ahead and get your website out there? I got so interested in what you were saying. Ordinarily, I get to that right after the break, but please go ahead. Let's get your website out. How can people get your book, Red Cocaine?
Well, the best way to get it is right on the Internet, and there's two places to go. I believe it's still carried by Amazon.com. The name of the book is Red Cocaine, and the publisher is Edward Harl, and it's also at EdwardHarl.com. That's E-D-W-A-R-D, Edward, and H-A-R-L-E, Harl. And other than that, you can probably just click on search on Google with Red Cocaine or my name, and eventually it would get there. So that's probably the easiest way, Dr. Stan.
In fact, we really should carry the book. If you know, I keep meaning, next time we get together, why, you remind me, then I'll get my staff to go ahead, and because we really want to carry that. Now, we do carry your other book, A Betrayed, but we really should carry Red Cocaine. The information is so vitally important. Our listeners need to have access to it. So, well, you've got about a minute and a half to wrap up the program for us.
Well, you know, there's something interesting that struck me the other day. I was asked to come out and talk to a women's club in Detroit, Michigan, that's having a lot of trouble in drugs and unemployment and crime. And recently there was a notice that the Ford Foundation was going to put something like $25 million into economic revitalization in the area, and that could grow to 75 or more. And what struck me is, how are they going to economically revitalize an area unless they start by cleaning out the drugs and the crime that are causing people to leave the city and want nothing to do with it? And when you think about it, it just seems like a logical thing. But whether or not they're going to do that, I've never heard anything.
Well, I think that really what's happening in Detroit is so tragic. You know, they got 15-18% unemployment there, large black contingent, large Muslim contingent, and this is a city on the way down. I don't know if it can be rescued at this point.
I don't know, but unless somebody gets serious about hitting the drug problem and the crime problem, they're not going to do it. And it struck me in putting together a talk for them that unless we change our perception about how we look at the war on drugs, nothing is going to get accomplished. Because we have this perception that says that the enemy is crooks, the government is doing all it can, that the banks are just victims, and the problem was with the American people because we can't wage war on our own people.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening's been Dr. Joe Douglas. As always, it's a real pleasure having you with us. Thank you very much for being with us and for sharing your years of study. I think that Dr. Douglas certainly has one of the best grasps of the drug problem of anybody I know in the country.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
God bless. Good night, and God bless you.
And good night to you.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Fine. That was Joe Douglas. And, of course, this is the time I really do want to mention that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. If you're out there in the listening audience, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us. We think that several books are very important. One of them is called Barry and the Boys. It's the story of the most successful of all drug dealers. He was a CIA undercover operator named Barry Seal. Barry and the Boys, then a book drugging America, a book defrauding America, and our four tape set, Is There Really a War on Drugs? If you'd like information about any of those items, well, you can always call us at 1-800-544-8927 to learn more about them. But I think the books, Barry and the Boys by Daniel Hofsinger, Drugging America by Rodney Stitz, and then Defrauding America by Rodney Stitz. If you get to that information, you'll understand that the war on drugs is really not a war on the drug production and distribution. It's a war on the soul and heart of the American people. And if you'd like more information, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, because as incredible as it may seem, most of what you think you know about the war on drugs just is not true. Now, to begin to put this thing into its spiritual perspective, because there is a spiritual component to everything, you need to read, I suggest you think about reading my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or that you hear the talk, Brotherhood of Darkness. It's available on DVD or video. And then, of course, my updated talk. It's called Forbidden Secret. Forbidden Secret. And it will tell you the secret that has been passed down for 5,000 years by members of secret societies. A secret that was so dangerous that nobody could ever reveal publicly what it was. And, of course, it's very interesting. We have a new DVD put up by our good friend Chris Petto called Riddles in Stone. And there you'll see a man who's written extensively on these subjects saying, you know, it's just a good thing. You know, 20 or 30 years ago, if I'd said this, why, it probably ought to have been burned at the stake, as he talked openly about these occult and dark spiritual forces. That DVD is Riddles in Stone. It accompanies a DVD entitled The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. Ladies and gentlemen, you have to become informed, first of all. And then you've got to help us inform others and learn how to talk to people. Don't accost them and beat them over the head. Learn how to ask questions. I mean, the questions like, how can it be that we've been fighting in Afghanistan for 5.5 years and we can't win the war? How could it be we fought a war for 10 years in Vietnam against a country the size of the state of Mississippi, and we lost that war? How could we have done such a poor job unintentionally? And then, of course, you take them into my books, and of course, everything we have there is well documented. It is up to you to reach as many people as you can in the time that is allotted to us. It is not up to you to convince them. It's up to you to tell them, and God will determine who is going to listen and who is not going to. Because indeed we are involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, educational, financial battlefield, and our job is to do our best. But in the final analysis, it's God's battle. And so we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. And if we do not have another great awakening, we're going to lose America, no question at all, because we've become a pagan nation, and eventually, oh, God does bring his judgment upon nations that turn against him. But lastly, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, this evening our guest is Nancy Levant. And Nancy has written a wonderful book, which we do carry, and I'm going to have her tell us the title of that. That's something the what is it, some American women? What's the title of the book, Nancy? Nancy?
The title of the book is The Cultural Devastation of American Women.
Cultural Devastation of American Women. Anyway, we carry that, and we've had so many good comments on that. And Nancy writes an article usually about once a week, but this last week she's been really very busy because it almost looks like she got two of them out, at least. I got two of them within just a few days, and they were both so good. I thought that, you know, I really wanted to get her on. And so she was good enough to come on this evening. And one of her articles really wasn't talking so much about women. It was talking about men and this effort to feminize men. And, of course, this whole idea of gender and the attack on masculinity, the attack on the dignity of men. And, of course, once you destroy manhood, why you destroy the ability to have men who will defend women, who will defend their country, who will preserve the very bulwark of society. So with that as a background, Nancy, you take over that story. I think you did it so well.
Thank you. Well, let me tell you about what I was thinking of with the article. The article is entitled The Systematic Emasculation of Men, and it is available on newswithviews.com and in other places, but go to News with Views and you'll find it there. And what I want readers to understand is that whenever you're dealing with a very, very highly funded and specifically a globally funded movement, as the feminist movement became in the United States, you have to look at the bigger picture of what is desired. Now, you know, initially when American people think of the feminist movement, they think of a movement that was going to help women get rights in the United States of America. But truthfully, that movement morphed into something very, very different. Whenever you talk about things global, whenever you talk about the politics of a one-world government developing, particularly in the United States of America, and these big lobbying organizations, the feminist lobby being only one, you're talking about a movement that has very extended and ulterior motives. Now, when you talk about the feminist movement, particularly in the United States of America, I say in my article that it simply cannot be argued that depopulation is a key aspect of the global governance mission. And that overall mission used the feminist movement to accomplish these goals. The feminist movement is very, very, very involved in the abortion industry, in the birth control industry, and now in the mental health and big pharma industries, which have moved into the lives of women and their children like a rat. Our public schools are literally crawling with the mental health, quote-unquote, professionals and advocates. And I mean literally in every school in the country, and now they're also into the daycare centers, by the way. But what you see and what has happened...
Hold on, we'll be back in just a moment. All right, go right ahead then, Nancy.
You know, what you see and what you know, for instance, in our schools, is that we have sex education, which is way, way, way beyond the reasonable parameters of parental expectation or desire. You see condoms being distributed to teenagers. You see the homosexuality acceptance training in all schools now, all public schools. And this comes directly out of the push and shove of the feminist lobby. Now, what these goals ultimately achieve for the lobby and the push of the lobby is depopulation. They are trying to get females to stop procreating, to instead of thinking of sex in a marital and a religious aspect, they want them to think of it as entertainment and sport, and to devalue birth and to devalue pregnancies. And it's worked like a charm. I mean, American women, American girls, see kind of sex as simply fun, something you have to be careful with so you don't get a disease. And, of course, if you get pregnant by accident, well, no problem. You just go abort the baby, no problem. And this is a sad, sad state of spiritual affairs for women all over the world, by the way. It's not just in the United States. And at the same time, the feminist movement has also really attacked the male gender. It has attacked the biological aspects of the male gender. The male gender, as we know, is the more aggressive gender. The male gender, as we know, is the more physically powerful gender. And this has been attacked. For the very biology of the male critter has been attacked and criminalized. It's a dangerous thing for men in the United States of America to express any anger whatsoever. And then at the same time, men who have always, historically, all throughout recorded history, have acted in defense of their homes, of their families, of their women and children, of their communities, of their states, and of their nations. All of a sudden, we see at the same time not only an American but a global push through the United Nations to total disarmament.
Hold that thought, we'll be back here in just a minute. Go right ahead there, Nancy. Go right ahead.
So we have this movement to disarm, specifically in the United States, the American male once again. And we have seen our Second Amendment rights chipped away, chipped away, chipped away. We now are walking around with gun-free zones everywhere. It's becoming more and more difficult to obtain arms, to attain accoutrements, and it's simply becoming very, very difficult. And then at the same time, you have a movement that also has moved our jobs off of the homeland. And so what you have, in effect, and you always have to look at these global missions because they act in sync with each other. You have men who have been financially damaged. They have been emotionally damaged by the attack on their biological instinctual selves. They have been intellectually damaged, of course, so have females through this horrible school system. And they are being defensively attacked by the chipping away of the Second Amendment rights. Now, this is a very, very large attack on all aspects of the male gender. At the same time, we have females now who have no moral problems whatsoever aborting unwanted pregnancies. And at the same time, you have this lessening of the intellect in women. And you see this in the fact that, women spend hours and fortunes on these absurd vanity regimens of tanning and bleaching and false fingernails and false breasts and plastic surgeries and chronic credit card spending. And you see women who, they have a baby. 6 weeks later, that baby's in daycare. 6 weeks later, that infant is in daycare. And so you have daycares, of course, are now all licensed by the state. They are government programs. You've got the government raising children from infancy on all the way through college. And you have women, you know, of course, they're also working because they have absolutely no choice because of the costs of things. But when you look at all of these things that I have just discussed in sync and at the same time, what you are actually seeing is, number one, the creation of the new citizenry for the world government, which is not a free citizenry, but you are also seeing that the men who are non-military men, in other words, the men who remain on the homeland, who are not now serving the UN peacekeeping missions all over the world, are being basically created into creatures who are incapable. They're financially incapable, they're intellectually incapable, emotionally incapable, and they are defensively incapable of defending the homeland. So it's a very, very big picture. And whenever you look at something like feminism, which is now funded by the UN, it's partnered to the UN, it is funded by corporate foundations all over the place. It's a huge, huge, powerful lobby. You best believe that these places, that these lobbying groups, no matter what they are, but I'm picking on the feminist lobby tonight, they have ulterior motives. And the ulterior motive, in my belief, for the feminist lobby of today's America is to, number one, emasculate your standard biological male, to render him financially and defensively incapable of defense of this nation, and at the same time, creating women who either don't or can't procreate. Now, another thing that's very interesting to me, if any of you are television watchers, I'm sure you have all seen the commercials on television that are now talking about a brand new, wonderful, and convenient drug that all but end the menstrual cycle. Isn't that something? And just recently, I read an article about some genetically modified corn that had been planted in Mexico. And the experiment was to see if this corn would render men infertile, and it, in fact, did. And I cannot say for certain that it was Monsanto, but, of course, whenever we talk about genetically modified food, you know, Monsanto comes to mind. But it could have been Monsanto, or it was another big company that did this experiment with this new type of corn. We also see new drugs that are targeted to our daughters, our children. Gardasil comes to mind, which is made by Merck, I believe. And Gardasil is to eliminate, I believe, cervical cancer. But at the same time, if you will look at the warnings on Gardasil, it says don't use this drug if you are pregnant. So in other words, what happens to that baby if you are pregnant and you're using Gardasil? Well, chances are that baby's not going to make it. And so, you know, there are very, very big pictures again in the world of the feminist lobby, very, very, very powerful feminist lobby.
Well, I think you've certainly given a very, very beautiful overview of that. There's one thing I would like to add, and that is that if you, of course, study testosterone levels in men, over the last 30 years, they dropped to about half, you know, for various levels of ages of men. Now, why would the testosterone level in men all across America be falling to half of what it was, you know, a comparable period 30 years ago? I mean, how would you do something like that? And nobody ever asked why. Why do so many men have sexual dysfunction today? You never saw this 30 years ago. You never saw all the ads, the discussions. What is going on with our men? And I will tell you, but nobody else is going to tell you, that if you study water fluoridation, you find out that it drops significantly the level of testosterone. We have the scientific studies out of India where they've demonstrated this. How could you conceal this from the American people? Well, in America, we have freedom of the press. If you own the press, you have the freedom to suppress whatever you want to. And any of our listeners out there would like to have me verify this, I'll send you the article out of the journal Fluoride that tells you just what I've told you. Of course, it also decreases the sperm count in men. It actually causes many of the sperm to be broken and not to function correctly. It affects women's fertility, increases the incidence of Down's disease, which is a result of the genetic damage, and you're seeing it increasingly in young women in areas where there's water fluoridation. And not one word about this from the U.S. Public Health Service, who tells us that water fluoridation is safe and effective. So that's one more thing next time you write the article, why you can add that right along with it, Nancy.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, people need to understand that the mission of global depopulation, massive, massive global depopulation, appeared a long time ago. In 1974, during the Carter administration, a report was issued actually to the Carter administration. It was called Goals 2000. And in this report, it said that that the actual depopulation goal for the United States of America was to lower the population, I believe, by about half by 2050. And, you know, the depopulation goal has been an ongoing goal for a very, very long time. And this is why, you know, the environmental movement moved in on this, and they created this sustainability crisis in the United States. We cannot, you know, sustain ourselves. The future generations cannot sustain themselves unless we get rid of, now the global goal is about two-thirds to three-fourths of the people on the planet. And so when you, the depopulation issue from a global government's point of view is massive, and they are right on target. You know, at the same time, we have this pandemic, this impending pandemic that we hear about day after day after day. And at the same time, superviruses are created day after day after day in labs all over the world, but specifically here in the United States.
You know, I was really very interested in your remark about this this corn that had been grown down in Mexico that would make men infertile. I know that we carry a little book on GMOs. They're called GMOs, Beware Genetically Modified Food. And there they tell the story about the pig farmers who were using these genetically modified corn on their pigs. And, the pigs were nice and fat, but there weren't any little pigs coming along because the sows weren't getting pregnant. And eventually they found that this genetically modified corn was actually causing the male pigs to become infertile. Now, I didn't realize that they had gone so far as to get this into human beings, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, after all, the honeybees are all disappearing, and nobody can figure out why. But, of course, they put something into the corn, and 70% of our corn has it, I think, that actually kills caterpillars. Every kernel of corn, every leaf on the corn, every bit of the corn has this item that will kill caterpillars. You notice we don't see the caterpillars in our corn anymore? But, of course, very soon we may not see any honeybees either. Why should we be surprised that something will kill caterpillars and it won't kill bees as well? Well, Nancy, you go ahead and pick up this story, and I share your concern about this concept of population control.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I think that we need to be very, very concerned when you consider, you know, the fluoridation of water, which, you know, we never had a say in. You know, all we ever heard 40 years ago was, oh, the government's doing this so that our teeth won't decay, which should have raised about 1,000 red flags, but I don't think it did at that point in the American consciousness. But you know, we look at TV and we are absolutely inundated with drugs. Drugs, brand new drugs. It's really during primetime advertising. That's about the only advertising, or primetime television. That's about the only advertising that we see anymore. And it just brings to mind that the human being has become a veritable petri dish of experimentation for this new science, these new sciences that are all funded by corporate governance. Now, I say corporate governance because our government takes the lead now from corporations, and that's just the way it is. It's all a money game. It's a banker's game. But we have become so disrespected in this nation by our government and by the corporate leadership of our government that we have literally just become science experiments. I keep reading about, and I'm not exactly sure of the pronunciation, it's Morgellons or Morgellons.
Yes, this is, and I really don't know too much about the disease, but apparently really it's spreading and more people. It's extremely distressing disease. It's one of those new diseases that, like Ebola and AIDS, but this one is so peculiar and bizarre.
Well,
where did it come from?
Well, I just read recently several articles that suggest, and these were articles that were written by scientists, that suggest that this very peculiar disease, which basically the symptoms of the disease is that you get very strange skin lesions, and then you get these little things coming out of these skin lesions that almost look like wires. And what they are suggesting is that this is nanotechnology. They're very concerned about the possibility of the contamination of the human body, maybe through the chemtrailing that's going on all across the country, though they're not sure. They actually did some research on the actual fibers that were literally growing out of human bodies, and they have ridiculously high melting points, something like 1,600 degrees. These are like, they fear that they're like wires that are somehow either being ingested or breathed or something, but they are growing inside of the human body. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. I saw actual photographs on some sites of people who have been infected with this very new and very strange disease. And it's absolutely awful what it does to the human body. But what is happening in this disease is you get terrible, terrible skin rashes, terrible skin lesions, and all of a sudden there's stuff growing out of your body. And that stuff happens to be a wire type of a substance.
We'll be back in just a moment. Just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Kirsten. Nancy has raised the question of all the new diseases we're seeing, and this is really true. And the government has spent hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, creating terrible new diseases. And if you doubt that they plan to do this, we actually have the testimony. It's available from Radio Liberty. A testimony of Dr. David MacArthur back in 1969 before the House Appropriations Committee, where he asked for $10 million to create an entirely new disease for which there'd be no treatment. The immune system would not respond. He said that some people thought that they shouldn't do this because it could be another means of mass killing, but they wanted to create this new disease. And then they wanted to create a chronic disease to disable people so that, the one disease would kill them, the other would just disable them. They wanted to do that as well. We know that this was planned because the following year, 1970, why Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, of course, is the man who created the Trilateral Commission and picked as their logo three intertwining sixes, six, six, six. In his book, Between Two Ages, and anybody would like to see the page, we'll send it to you, talks about how in the future, why they're going to be able to create storms and droughts, and then they're going to be able to create chronic new diseases to disable the enemy. Well, we know about 10 years later, we had our first cases of a new form of mycoplasma. We know that the German scientists have been working on that in Germany. We brought them here. They continued working on it. And so we began to see all sorts of manifestations of new forms of a mycoplasm. 25% of all flu cases are mycoplasm, 25% of pneumonia, atypical pneumonia, mycoplasm. Mycoplasma is an integral part of the AIDS epidemic, although, of course, they've never told the doctors that. But at least 90% of everybody with AIDS also has this genetically modified type of mycoplasm. And, of course, then we have the chronic fatigue syndrome. We have fibromyalgia. We have Lyme disease. A million people with Lyme disease, 2 million with fibromyalgia, 1 million with chronic fatigue syndrome, another 1 million with AIDS. And where did they all come from? And then, of course, we have Ebola and Marburg's disease, and now we've got this new Morgellons disease. And people find it difficult, I think, Nancy, to believe that anybody would be evil enough to create new diseases that would kill off hundreds of millions of people, but I believe that's exactly what is planned.
Well, you know, disease has become a very, very profitable high science. It's massively funded. It continues generation after generation, as you said, and it's always been used as a lethal weapon. You know, wars, Agent Orange, alcohol to the Native Americans when we first came over here. I mean, it's not like this is new. And, you know, many pharmaceutical drugs are dangerous to the elderly. They're very dangerous to pregnant females. We know for a fact that new drugs have been engineered to all but eliminate menstrual cycles and to render men infertile. Genetically modified food has also been used to render people infertile. Now, I'm sorry, but when you're talking about genetically modified food, you're talking about poison. And so you're talking about genocide. I'm sorry, but those are the facts.
Yeah, because the thing is that once you have this food out there, you're growing the fields, why, the pollen spreads to the next field and the next field and the next field. And they're saying, oh, shucks, gee, we never knew this was going to happen. Well, we've contaminated all of these fields, this whole crops, this whole area of the country with this pollen that has changed the very structure, the genetic structure of certain of the foods. Today, we've unleashed these things, and nobody is telling the American people what we've done. But, you know, when you stop and think, what's going to happen when there are no honeybees or almost no honeybees? And in many areas, we've lost 90% of the honeybees, and you have to have honeybees for about a third of the crops we grow. Do you think that that's just stupidity? Or do you think maybe there are people who would like to use massive famine because there are too many people in the world? And we're going to be back here in a few minutes, and yes, I think we'll take your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Our guest is Nancy Levant, and if you haven't read her book give me that title once more.
It's The Cultural Devastation of American Women.
The Cultural Devastation of American Women. It's a great book, and we've had more good comments on that. And, of course, that's available, but if you'd like to know more about it, why call us at 1-800-544-8927, but if you'd like to talk to us here at the studio, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Nancy Levant, and we always enjoy having Nancy with us. And she's written another article recently, and it goes into the Trilateral Commission. Of course, is one of my favorite subjects, because this is a visible manifestation of one of these occult organizations made up of some of the people of great, great wealth who are really running the world today. And, of course, from if we want to put things into clear perspective, what is the purpose of the Trial Out for Commission? The purpose of the Trial Out for Commission is to gain control of the financial and commercial aspects of the whole world. In other words, finances and commercial activities throughout the world by first taking control of the American government. That's what Barry Goldwater wrote back in 1979 in his book, With All Apologies, trying to warn the American people about the Trial Out for Commission. And as he said, what these people really want to do is simply by breaking down tariff barriers and increasing trade, they want to do away with national sovereignty. And by doing away with national sovereignty, we'll get some people so wound up in materialism and benefiting financially that they won't be concerned about these outlandish ideas of sovereignty or freedom. And then he went on to talk about the importance of spirituality. They wanted to use ecclesiastic control. In other words, they wanted to use the church to control the people. And I very much fear that this is in the process of taking place today. So we're going to first get Nancy to discuss this whole issue, because she's written another great article going into the background of these internationalists. But of course, what most people have missed as they analyze the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Club of Rome, the Bilderbergers, is that there are powerful spiritual forces that are energizing these men and have rewarded them well for their abandonment, you know, of any sense of honor or integrity. These men, motivated by money, are fabulously wealthy. Anything they want in the world, they can have. But, of course, many of them, of course, have pledged their souls to another god and have certainly been well rewarded for that. If you have not yet seen the videos, they sold their souls for rock and roll. You need to. And then, of course, you can understand why these people of great wealth are as prosperous as they are. We'll be right back in just a moment with Nancy Levant. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I'm going to ask Kevin and Paul, who are calling in, to just hang on, because I want Nancy to develop this idea. She did a great job in her recent article. You'll find it posted on News Reviews about the internationalists. So you pick up the story there, Nancy.
Well, now, are you talking about the Trilateral Commission?
Yes, right.
Okay, well, you're right. It's just another one of the richest people in the world, basically. And they form these groups. So you've got the Trilateral Commission, you've got the Council on Foreign Relations, you got the Bilderbergers, and you've got, you know, the training grounds for these groups and the Ivy League secret societies like the Skull and Bones. And basically what these guys do is they crafted the plans, and they started way before 1973. Trilateral Commission came into being in 1973, and this whole globalism or the one world government plan came into effect long before that. But the Trilateral Commission basically really, really wanted to open up the so-called free trade plan, which basically eliminated the sovereignty of nations and the borders of nations, because it was more profitable for them and their corporations then if they didn't have the trade limitations of different nations to sell their wares and to use the cheapest possible foreign labor. It was simply a way to make more money, make more profits, steal the wealth of nations. And it's basically an organization that is devoted to that cause and to basically a corporate-based government, meaning their corporations lead the government or become the government. And it's just, you know, it's a very soulless, it's heartless, it is, they, and the reason that they push the issue of getting rid of the world's primary religions, and particularly Christianity, is because they don't want the people believing in higher powers than themselves. They don't like that. They want to be the rulers. You know, these people literally lost their souls. They lost their humanity, in my opinion, due to just absurd pathological greed. Now, unfortunately for us, when with the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations, many of which are members in both, the problem for us is, due to their great wealth, great wealth, they basically bought our political system, and I mean literally bought. We have not had in 34 years a candidate for the President of the United States that hasn't come out of the Trilateral Commission. Now, that's scary because, you know, we think that we select and find and elect, you know, candidates for high office in the United States of America. But, in fact, we, the people, do not do that. The Trilateral Commission does, or the Council on Foreign Relations. And so, in other words, we are given hand-selected, hand-prepared people who magically become our only candidates of choice. You know, it doesn't matter where you're going to, you know, you're going to elect a Bush or you're going to elect a Kerry, Clinton, Carter. I mean, on and on and on down the line. And, you know, it's we need to watch very carefully who our candidates may be. Now, Hillary, her husband, I believe, is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She is not, but so what? Her husband is. I'm trying to think. Well, you know, I'm not even sure. You know, we're not even exactly sure who our candidates will play, our final candidates will play out to be in this election. I think this is going to be a very, very interesting election. But, you know, history dictates to us now, contemporary American history dictates, that our candidates are going to come out of either the Trilateral Commission or the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, this is our big, huge problem in the United States of America, because we, the American people, are very, very addicted to the red and the blue. We cannot get past the two-party, very tyrannical and very trilateral system of governance. And, of course, it has all but erased our constitutional governance and our freedoms, our subsequent freedoms. And, you know, we are still very nervous about the quote-unquote, the third parties. But if we continue, and if we continue to elect red and blue, then we're simply going to lose the nation, because that's what these people intend to do.
Right. They really don't want us to have any choice. They want to have a choice of, you know, either the Republicans or the Democrats, and they control the leadership of both parties. And Professor Carol Quigley, who is Bill Clinton's mentor, laid it all out beautifully in a book he wrote back in 1966 called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. On page 1247 and 1248, he said, look, this is the way that it is. You have to have two parties that are just about the same, so that people can go to the polls every 4 years and vote the rascals out, but foreign and domestic policies do not change.
Now, well, and see, the sadness of it all is that the American people still think that the Republican Party is the quote-unquote the Christian Party, and they think that the Democratic Party is the progressive party. That they have a larger and more worldly and more contemporary view of the world. But the problem is that both parties are global loyalists.
And I think there's no better place than seeing in this last 10 days when of course, they were going to vote on the budget for the for military budget. And somebody had put an amendment onto the legislation that said the president could not go to war with Iran without congressional permission. And Nancy Pelosi got that off of there. in effect telling President Bush, if he wants to go to war with Iran, he's not going to get any objection from the Congress of the United States. And everything else is showbiz, arguing back and forth, slamming one another, criticizing one another. It simply has to do with creating the perception there's a difference between the two political parties, which there is not. The Democrat-controlled Congress has given the president permission to go to war with Iran when the vast majority of the American people want to get our troops out of Afghanistan and out of Iraq, and the last thing they want to do is go to world war with the entire Islamic world, and that's exactly what is being planned by the leaders, the people who really rule America. Well, let's go to Kevin, who's calling from Austin, Texas. He's been waiting patiently on the line. Hey, Kevin, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Dr. Stan. You guys are great. Nancy is fabulous.
She really is. I love to have her on.
She's great. Nancy, I want all my sisters to hear you, all my sisters in the Lord, you know?
Thank you so much. You
are telling the truth. You make me think of Henry Macau. He's a Jewish fellow, and he talks about the same subjects you talk about.
Yeah, okay, we know.
I know Henry.
I love Henry too. He's great. I mean, you know,
Henry's a truth teller.
Okay, do you have a question or comment, Kevin?
Well, this thing with the guys that got arrested there in the British sailors, they put them in harm's way.
Right.
They got snatched by the guys, the Iranians, and they let them go. Right. It's all show, right?
Right. It's showbiz.
Showbiz. No, I just called to tell you guys that you guys are great. You're telling the truth.
All right. Well,
I really appreciate it.
Appreciate your words of encouragement.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Hang in there. Thank you, bud.
Bye-bye. And, of course, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We've got Paul calling from Ohio. Paul, did you have a question for our guest?
Hey, welcome to the USA. Slave Association. I was wondering what the remedy is for this situation. Is it through two arms or
Paul, Mike, you're probably going to have to speak up.
Fire is growing out of our skin or something. Here.
Well, this is a disease known as Morgellons disease.
Is it going to be antennas or what is it?
Well, we're going to have to read up a little bit. You're going to have to look up a little into it. But the information is out there on the Internet. It's a terrible disease associated with rashes and pain. And then these little filaments growing out of the skin.
Ooh.
That's Morgellons disease. Thanks for calling, Paul. And we're going to be back here. Our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Nancy on either subject, and I think that certainly her first subject is so important, the demasculinization of men, and you'll find the article at newswithviews.com. That's newswithviews.com. And then, of course, her article on the Trilateral Commission, is that, and of course this whole thing of globalization, is that posted up on the Internet?
Yes. If you just Google search the title, I believe that you'll find it. It's also in the archives at newswithviews.com.
All right, and I think it's so important that people really understand this is not imaginary. These groups really do exist. These groups really are dedicated to the destruction of the sovereignty of our nation. And with that, of course, the loss of our constitutional guarantees of freedom, and, of course, once the Constitution is no longer in vogue, then no man's life or property are safe. And the one reason that they've not done away with the Constitution is because if they tried to do that, they would be lawbreakers themselves, so they're doing everything they can to circumvent the Constitution, to prevent people from understanding it, and they're certainly hoping the American people will not realize that the president and the vice president and his entire cabinet and most of the members of Congress have sworn to uphold the Constitution, and they're violating that oath, and they really should be held responsible. If they swear an oath to uphold the Constitution, don't you think they should do it? Well, let's go to Jeannie, who's calling here from the Silver Beach. Hi, Jeannie. Haven't heard from you for a while.
Yeah, I'm busy. I'm living.
Okay, good to hear from you.
It's good to hear Nancy this evening. I did want to mention, you mentioned about the military appropriations bill that just passed. And one of the items that was non-Iraq associated was to buy vaccines for the pandemic flu. $1 billion they voted to buy vaccines. So we wonder what they have planned in store for us.
Well, I will tell you, Jeannie, I'm not going to take their vaccines because we know, for instance, that the AIDS epidemic was originally disseminated in the United States. In the experimental vaccine that was given, the hepatitis B vaccine given to homosexuals, and of those people who took it in San Francisco, of the homosexuals that took it, 75% came down with AIDS. But nobody ever wants to tell you that. We know that in the vaccines that they've given in Thailand and in the Philippines and in Kenya, they've given it to women of childbearing age, and it's had a Corrigan atrophic in it that will prevent them from being pregnant. We know that certainly they've used experimental vaccines on our young men over in the first Gulf War, and we have a book called Vaccine A and a four-tape set on Vaccine A, going into how so many of these people, well over 80,000 of them, are already dead. Of the 695,000 we sent to the Gulf 12 years ago, young, healthy men, I'm sorry, that would be, 17 years ago. I mean, 80,000 are now dead. And if you want to verify this, anybody wants the figures from the Veterans Administration, we'll be glad to send them. And a third of them are seriously ill. The same thing is happening after this, after the current war. You just can't trust them because you don't know what.
Well, and we know for a fact that autism is linked to childhood vaccinations that contain mercury.
Right.
Well, that's devastating facts. But, Nancy, thanks for your book. And I might remind you, there are some real women out here.
I know there are, by gosh, and thank God for you.
Okay. Night, Dr. Stan.
Good night, Jeannie. Thank you so much. Well, let's go to Terry calling from Sun Valley. Hi, Terry. How are you doing?
Well, hi, Dr. Stan. When your guest was speaking, and you were about the infertility and so forth earlier,
right.
I thought of that movie, The Children of Men. That came out about 3 months ago.
Tell us about it. I don't know the movie.
Well, in the movie, it takes place in the near future, about 15 years from now. There's some sort of strain of disease which makes all the women infertile, but I think men are actually, if I read it right, men are actually able to have babies, but not women. Finally, one woman is found who is able to get pregnant in the time-tested way.
Well, that's a little far-fetched, but anyway, it sounds like it might be interesting.
Because I was thinking, when you were talking about infertility and men being disarmed, it seems that even far back in antiquity, some of these secret groups they're like all male priest groups, and they couldn't have children because they were all male priest groups. So they think now through technology they will replace the time-tested way of having children through some sort of technical means where women will essentially be made obsolete in their way of thinking.
No, I don't think I think that's a little too far out. But anything else you wanted to say, Terry?
No, I just hope that I'm wrong.
I think that you are. Because, you see, God made us the way he did.
That's
he
right.
Made
well, see, the main issue is depopulation of the planet by 2/3 to 3/4. And they have set a goal for the year 2050. And so, you know, they are definitely messing with the reproductive capabilities of men and women. At the same time, they're pushing and pushing and pushing the rights of abortion globally. They want to lower the numbers of the quote-unquote commoner on the planet in order that the sustainability of the elite can be maintained. That is my opinion.
How will things get done if there's so few people, though?
What's that?
How will things get done if there's so few people?
Well, there would be very, very few people. There would be the servants, and then, of course, there would be elite. And they figure about maybe 100,000, and there'll be the elitists, and then there'll be the servants. And maybe it'll be robots. Thanks for calling there, Terry.
Welcome back.
Well, see, the other thing to think of, too, is, you know, they're trying to centralize a global army. There's no global army on Earth. that is going to control the number of people that are on Earth right now. It can't be done. But, you know, if they get rid of three-quarters of the world's people, then maybe it can be. You know, you have to look at the big picture. Whenever you're talking about political intent in today's day and age, you have to look at the big picture.
Nancy, do you have a webpage you want to get out?
Well, you know, I don't have my own.
Right, fine. Then we'll just say newsofviews.com.
Newswithviews.com, or just Google search using my name, and I'm all over the place.
All right, Nancy, you got 3 minutes to wrap up tonight's program.
Well, I think that the main things to consider for all of us, no matter what your religious affiliation, it is time for deep, deep introspection. We have got to, number one, study. We have to understand the big picture. You know, in many ways, the watchdogs of this big situation have failed the American public because oftentimes we get stuck in a specific place on a specific issue that's important to us, like maybe land rights, or maybe it's gun rights, or maybe it's this right or that right. But you have to see the big picture of this thing. What one thing that I would suggest people do is we need to understand that this country has been operating in a declared state of emergency since March the 9th of 1933. We have never been taken out of a declared state of emergency. And all it takes when our country operates, and this is by law, when our country operates in a declared state of emergency, which we have been in a state of emergency since 1933, all it takes is the signature of one person, being the President of the United States, to institute martial law in this country. Once martial law is instituted, FEMA becomes the head of military policing force in the United States. And the first thing that happens is the Constitution is suspended. Now, once that happens, Congress cannot, for 6 months, even think about lifting martial law up and out of the country again. And a martial law system has been set into place. There are many, many paramilitary systems that are brand new now operating in the United States. Department of Homeland Security, FEMA is now under the Department of Homeland Security. The American 501c3 faith-based churches are now under the regulation of the Department of Homeland Security. And so basically what we see is a paramilitary system that is ready to operate in this country with one signature.
And, of course, we've done away with the Posse Comitatus law. Now, of course, the president can mobilize the National Guard without the permission of the state governor. Everything is in place for a military dictatorship. And where's the outcry from the American people? Nancy Levant, God bless you. Thanks so very much for being with us again.
Thank you, Dr. Monteith. Good to be with you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our program with Nancy, and I always do. And Nancy was good enough to come on in very short notice tonight, but actually, of course, I'd read her articles and wanted to get her on anyway. And I hope you enjoy them. I hope you'll go and get them with newswithviews.com. And they're well worthwhile reading if you don't have access to the Internet. Of course, we'd be glad to send them to you if you have not gotten things from us before. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Well, it's so important that you understand what is really going on. Because behind all of the things we've been talking about today are powerful spiritual forces. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or seen the video or DVD, let me recommend that. And then, of course, my latest talk, Forbidden Secret. Really explains how this all fits together. And, of course, we do hope many of you will want to get that and the syllabus that goes with it. The Forbidden Secret DVD is ready for you right now. We also, of course, we have a new four-tape set with Constance Cumby, who's been studying the hidden dangers of the rainbow and the New Age movement, frankly, Luciferian movement in the United States for, well, 27 years now. And we have a DVD with Constance, or a video. We have four-tape set. We carry a book, The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. So we do hope many of you want to get that information. And then, of course, we carry Chris Pinto's new DVD, Riddles in Stone, his previous DVD, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, because they trace the secret societies here in the United States back for 400 years. In fact, it traces them back to Elizabethan England, the time of Queen Elizabeth, in the late 1500s. And of course, I think she died in the early 1600s. And, of course, you need to have this information so that you can understand that there have been two forces in America, one the Christian and the other the occult. The Christian leaders will tell you, oh, we were a Christian nation. We were, in many respects, a Christian nation because there were many Christians here when the nation was founded. But they're also the occultists, and they do not want you to know that. And they want to tell you that the emblem on the back of the dollar bill, the triangle capped by the all-seeing eye, is a Christian symbol, and that is simply a lie. It was an occult symbol that goes back for 5,000 years. And if you doubt that, we actually have an interview with Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, and you can get the Carol Quigley interview where he actually talks and says, these crazy right-wingers want to tell us that the emblem on the back of the dollar bill has to do with the Illuminati. He said, why, that's ridiculous. That emblem has been around 5,000 years. And he's absolutely right. So why are our Christian leaders trying to convince us that that's a Christian emblem? I mean, you can read anything into it, but that's not why it was put in the back of the Great Seal of the United States in 1782, or in the back of the dollar bill, by a man deeply involved with the occult in 1935. So understand they were involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. We ask people to begin making preparations for the difficult times that lie ahead. Of course, we hope many of you will join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, but also begin making personal preparations, financial, fiscal, and spiritual, preparing yourself, because I think we're in for some very difficult times. If you'd like a health catalog, if you'd like a long-term storage food catalog, you really need to have those things in place. The water filters, the barrels, other things you will need. If you'd like information on any of the things, my suggestions of what you may want to do, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. And then please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. If there's not a great revival, if there's not another great awakening, we're going to lose America. Good night.